This show contains spoilers, so if you don't want to know, you shouldn't listen.
Hello and welcome to Marvel Noise. I'm your guest host, Derek Howard. Marvel Noise can be found at marvelnoise.com. And it's part of the Deliberate Noise Network. For more details and links to all the shows, please go to deliberatenoise.com. If you would like to send feedback, you can email the regular host at David, that's D-A-V-I-D, at comicbooknoise.com, or you can call the audio comment line at 734-331-0772. You can also follow Marvel Noise on Facebook or Twitter, but I don't think on Instagram. And for those of you who listen to Comic Book Noise, that's my daily comic book podcast, and that, you know, that that's just a variation on what I, on how I open each show. David is unable to do the hosting duties this weekend, so he asked me to. However, normally I can think of something to do, because normally David will contact me at, let's say, 7:50 and say, hey, Derek, can you host the show? And so then by 8 o'clock, I'm recording. And I can usually come up with a topic. But I've been partaking, because today's my birthday, and I've been partaking of a few adult beverages. So right now, I'm lucky that I am not slurring my words. So instead of you listening to the drunken ravings of a semi madman, I'm just going to turn things over to Steve and the rest of Rakers Raiders and say come back next week and David will be come back next time and David will be a lot more coherent than I am right now. Thanks.
Hey, denizens of the Deadlands. Perfectionist Steve Raker here from the Comic Book Bunker, along with exiled Barons Andrew the L.A. Rabbit and Kevin Whirlwind X. Over the shield with you all.
I'm spitting venom all over these comics. No, I'm just kidding.
We're back.
We are. And you can find us on Twitter at Marvel Noise and at WWXKev and at Steve Raker and at LA_Rabbit1. And you can also listen to us plus Phil over on our sister show, Indie Comic Book Noise, here on this same Deliberate Noise Network family of podcasts. And in September, I am going to the 16th annual Baltimore Comic Con at the Baltimore Convention Center, September 25th, 26th, and 27th. And there's a great guest list. It's a visitor-friendly locale with the Inner Harbor of Boston being walking distance. And the Harvey Awards take place there. And plus, it's not New York City Comic Con. So it's got all that going for it. I'll be there, and it would be fun to see you there, too.
Cool. I don't know if I'll see anyone at Fan Expo Canada in early September, but that would be cool.
You were just at San Diego.
Yes, I still have the privilege of somehow finding my way down to the lovely San Diego Comic-Con International.
Yeah, they tell me there's no comics there anymore, but I don't believe them.
They're right. Not a single comic or comic-related property.
I'm glad to hear that our little show, though, has enough clout that you get full press credentials throughout the San Diego Comic-Con weekend experience.
I had zero press credentials.
You had free drinks with that?
I did go to the Comic Book Legal Defense Party, which didn't have free drinks. And you had to, you know, give to the Comic Book Legal Defense Fund, but there were drinks there. Does that count?
Goes to a good fund. Fun, that's for sure. Good cause.
Yes, yes. That's always a fun early party, but it's always an overwhelming experience. One of the things I love about hearing about people's Comic-Con's experiences, it's always different. Like, no two people, I mean, in every way, no two people have the same show, but in San Diego, it really is radically different. Even the crew you're rolling with all have their own stories and adventures, and they went off this way and you went off that way, and it really is a magical place. So for all the enormous expense and headache, and my battery died when I was down there, and all kinds of other adventures, car battery, which made an exciting last day. You know, it's still, there's nothing like it. We had decided we were going to go to the Muppets panel because they have a new TV show coming out. Muppets, a Disney product, as is Marvel, so I feel it's tangentially related. Mm-hmm. But on the way to the Muppets panel, we decided we'd go early and sit through some of the early panels, and one of the panels was Marvel Digital.
Huh.
So there has been an enormous crush, I feel like, and this was also reiterated at C2E2, Marvel's really trying this integration thing. They're really pushing cross-platform, mainly with things like the Unlimited service, which I know we're all members of, in addition to their, like, mobile gaming and handheld device, and they have their, whatever their equivalent is to that Skylanders game. Infinite, is that what it's called, Steve?
Yeah, yeah. The Infinity. Disney Infinity.
Infinity.
It's all, yeah. Disney properties, though, not just Marvel.
Right. But they were giving away a special to the kid with the best question, got a special,
oh, cool,
like Hulkbuster limited edition. There was a little girl dressed as Rescue, and I think she got it. Or, you know, they always have the little kids cosplaying, and they go up and ask questions, and it's kind of fun. So there's been this real, and then they'll cross it again with, they'll talk about a lot of the web series they do, like the Watcher thing, and then they do some, where they take the little figures and they animate them and have humorous stories behind it. I don't know if you guys go to the website, marvel.com, and watch any of that stuff.
No,
I don't really.
I know that The Watcher exists. That's just like their weekly in-house news show, right?
Yes, so there's a real chance to sort of, they're really attempting to kind of integrate all these things, but they have recognized that there's a hole in their platform gaming. They're real big on mobile, and I play a few of the mobile ones. They have a Jewel Quest game that I play, and I've played the Avengers Alliance and a few of the other ones, but they're working to try and get a console to kind of tie it all together, other than the Disney Infinity thing, but a Marvel-specific one.
And Lego. They have that great Lego Marvel game.
Yes.
Yeah. I want some Amiibos.
So I was just impressed with everything, and I did ask about, on the Marvel Unlimited woman was there, and I asked her about when they're going to integrate more of their titles. And she was like, oh, we already have everything up there. And I'm like, you don't have everything up there. What? Because I've been lately trying to catch up on a lot of the 90s stuff. I think there was just, she was more of a tech person and less of maybe a comic person.
Or maybe she means everything that is already like digitized, yes, for trades and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Because I don't know that they go through and scan comics specifically for that service, right? It's all stuff that they've, for the most part, it seems like a lot of the newer stuff is stuff that comes out on trade. Like you see that all of a sudden Moon Knight's coming out in a color, yes, trade, and all of a sudden the Moon Knight series is going to be, finally we're going to get the Munch Sienkiewicz stuff. So I think that's the kind of the way it goes, which makes sense. They're spending the time and the money to digitize something. They should be able to use it for a masterworks and a trade, and then on the digital service too.
I completely agree. I was just kind of, because what I like for is kind of one-time read, so I'm trying to catch up on some of the, like the 90s Cage series, the 90s Terror, right, Inc., like just that stuff that I'm never going to read more than once, but it would be nice just to kind of click through it.
Oh, fair enough.
And then after that, I don't know if I can talk about this. There was a guy that used to work for Marvel. Stan Lee had a panel. I know he's no longer Marvel associate. It's his POW Entertainment.
He was in Ant-Man.
And what was funny was I forgot how much fun the Stan show is. You know what I mean? I'm sure you guys have seen him in a panel or two.
Nope.
And
nope.
It's just been a few years.
Seen video of it.
And I just forgot how kind of like, you know, he's been doing this literally since the late 60s, and he's just really good about, he always has clever comebacks, and he has that kind of false braggadocio persona he puts on that's kind of funny. You know what I mean? About,
he's,
well, you
great.
Can give me,
he's
all the
Stan.
Credit. Yeah. And it was just a fun, I'm like, you know, it's been years since I've seen him, and I'm glad the Stan show is still fun, because they had Jimmy Palmiotti moderating, and he's known Stan forever. And he's a really good moderator, because Stan's hearing isn't great, so sometimes he would repeat the questions to Stan right, you know, in his ear so he could answer them. And it was mostly Q&A. They also had one of Stan's POW partners there, who I was unfamiliar with. So it was just the three of them up there having fun. And he's got a fair number of properties. Colleen Doran worked on a graphic novel of his life that's coming out in November that looks kind of interesting. I like her. She's a distant soil. I mean, she's done some Marvel work, but
that graphic novel is his life story, though. It's a biography. It just was solicited this month, actually. You can get it in a big hardcover slipcase thing, or for like a heck of a lot cheaper, like under $20, you can get the softcover.
Because she, when I, in my youth, that distant soil was always a little racy with some, you know, partial nudity and that sort of thing. And I like that. It seems like, not that I think his graphic novel will contain that, but it was just fun.
Have you seen some of those pictures of Stan? Like the centerfold with him with the bear in front of him? Oh, man.
And he had a TV show that was picked up in England, Lucky Man. And he has an Indian comic that's come out. It just seems like, I'm glad he's still running the gamut out there.
Yeah,
and if you get a chance to see his show, like, he still is good. He still, like I said, has a funny joke here or there and knows how to work a crowd. And he's been answering those questions. But please, for the love of Pete, don't ask him about any comic book stuff unless it's more than 30 years old. Because people always go up with some, what do you think of this or that? Yeah. And it's like, he hasn't read a comic since 71, probably, I'd say. I mean, maybe he's consultant or something.
What do you think about when Wolverine lost the adamantium?
Yeah. It's like,
what about when you were writing Ravage 2099?
And you used a hubcap as a shield. Were you thinking of Captain America or the Taskmaster?
But the bigger questions are always, you know, kind of the big picture scope. And it was just a lot more. Then I was like, wow, this is pretty cool. Like, Stan still got it, and he's still fun. I wish...
got your money's worth out of Stan.
No matter what you feel about him. Well, I guess if you feel he robbed and cheated everybody, you wouldn't go. But if you can put aside whatever, how you feel about how people's situations worked out, it's a fun time to go.
Considering he himself had to sue Marvel and that he didn't get a big payoff from Goodman himself... How did he steal and cheat everybody? He was on his way out, and because Marvel got sold, and they wanted Stan to go along with the sale, because that's how he got his big deal. That's how he got his money. So, you know, you could say that he stole creative, ownership somehow of characters by some of the comments. Or you could argue that he was speaking for the company when he talked about himself, saying that, you know, when I made this one or that one or whatever. But monetarily, I don't think you can really say that he... All right, Andrew.
Yes. Would you like to hear more San Diego?
Yes.
I would. I want to hear about artist editions that are not going to get made.
I don't know if that's... proper for the Marvelous Noise podcast, or more independently. Because
the Marvel ones always get made.
Well, isn't Amazing Fantasy 15, like, don't they have that at a museum or something?
It's in the Library of Congress.
Yeah.
Ramita Man brought stats of two complete issues of Ditko Spider-Man.
Ooh.
So wow. I went down to his booth and looked at them. I mean, they weren't super high quality copies, but still just, yeah. And one of them was, the issue, the, what is it, 36, or the one where he lifts up all the metal.
Cool.
Oh.
Like that, he has that entire issue, and I'm like, wow. Good gravy. That's, there's some nice, and the other one was, one of the, one of the Spider Slayer ones with the Scorpion.
Nice.
I probably should have noted the numbers on those, but I loved looking at that stuff. I'm like, man, I just want a page of that, much less two whole issues of it. Get out of here, son. No, I'm mad at IDW. They promised announcements. It had no announcements, that whole panel. Hmm. They had a job in me. Scott Dunbeer. But I did get some. I did go back to the Marvel Unlimited Plus members only panel. But it was funny. They had it in this huge ballroom that sits like thousands, and there's, you know, like 200 of us. It's literally the first few rows, and that's it. And I went because they give you a free goodie.
Yeah, yeah.
But I'm such a sucker. Like, what a maroon.
It was lame this time, too?
Yeah,
it was a San Diego would have been a little something more.
It was the variant cover of Thor's one, but it's the variant cover where they just take the color out.
What?
Whoa, whoa. And I hate that variant. You know how they, wow. That's like a new variant. It's not like
just
black
gave
and white.
You a blank like, variant.
When I read the description of like the ultra premium, you know, Marvel Unlimited, I was like, nah, son, man, this doesn't sound like they're going to do anything too good. And to hear, I mean, it breaks my heart, but at the same time, I'm not surprised. I saw it coming a mile away, man.
So, I mean, I don't, maybe those things are worth a lot, but to me, it's like such a cheap variant. Like, it doesn't cost them anything. I mean, I don't know, do they pay the artist twice because they use the cover? I mean, it just seems like kind of a cheeky monkey giveaway. Yeah. Although next year, if I stay Plus Unlimited or if you guys upgrade, the figure will be Rescue instead of Rocket.
Is it a Marvel Legends Rescue that they're never going to do?
No, no, no. It's the smaller size. I tweeted a picture of my little Rocket. It was a really nice figure, actually. Did you see that, Kevin? Like the jaw works, kind of like Beta Ray Bill. And it's a cool design.
Yeah, I think that's decent because at least he's supposed to be, you know, like you're going to be able to tell if, you know, you can't put Rescue in with the Legends if they're not a...
No, no, I think she's going to be the same. Maybe she is, but I'm just basing it on the fact that Rocket was little, that she is, and then, you know, a couple of comics, like last time we got a special Rocket variant, number one.
I guess I should be happy that these aren't, like, important characters that I'll never own. Like, I think they did an Ultron or something before, and I was just like, eh.
I also wonder if you could probably pick these up maybe on the cheap on eBay for less than the difference.
Not on the cheap, probably.
There just isn't, like I said, if you can go to the conventions, you at least get to go to these things. So at the show, they showed a bunch of, it was a bunch of the same thing about like panels of comics coming out in 2 weeks or what. And it's like, please don't tweet. And then you're like, is anybody really concerned that this is going to get leaked like a week early or whatever? Like scans of art. But the nice thing is being in the big ballroom, it had the giant screens. So you got to see the artwork on these huge, massive, and that was cool. I mean, that I'll give you. Like, it's better than, normally we're in the little room that sits a couple hundred. You know what I mean? Like, the projector's big, but these are like the giant, you know, movie quality type projection. So that was pretty fun. And then they did, like, a lot of the kind of Civil War trailers and stuff. But they had it branded. I don't remember what Agent M's real name is, Ryan Pagalo, whatever it is. So it's like his name and then like property of Marvel 2015. So like a third of the screen is badgered with this for the whole thing. And they showed like an 8 minute clip of Ant-Man. But what was cool is I saw the whole first episode of the Guardians of the Galaxy cartoon.
Oh, was it good?
If you guys are interested in it, it's very based out of the world created by the movie, but Cosmo has a significantly increased role in the first episode.
Excellent.
Mm.
Is he speaking, you know, with
broken Russia? Telepathic English? Excellent. Like the whole kind of, like, he doesn't talk. I mean, some obvious gags with Groot and Rocket, like a dog, how a dog would react to a tree and a raccoon type creature. Nowhere is meant, because obviously that's where they run into him. they're fighting flunkies of Thanos, so it feels like it's going to be like they probably never get to Thanos, but they're always going to be chasing. So you'll see bits of like the guy Hollow communicating with them, but not him, and the return of the terribly disappointing Yondu. That's the one thing from the movie that I was really kind of like, that's not a Yondu I needed back, but he's back.
That's the thing?
Yeah, I like the old kind of classical Yondu who was more like, you know,
in touch. That was in the future.
The hippie Yondu, not the white trash Yondu.
But isn't hippie Yondu in the future?
Yes, but I just didn't need white trash Yondu at all. Like, call him something else. But I guess they really wanted the arrow gimmick, which is really nice. Like, it's a cool weapon, and they wanted that. But so that so if you like that, where, you know, where Star-Lord's kind of that slacker type, and the rest are always so their tension is that whole thing between being good guys versus bad guys. The same kind of thing, like how mercenary they are versus doing good deeds type of tension. And the first one ends with a cliffhanger. So I think if you're into the Marvel animated U, this fits right in.
Ooh.
well. I mean, they have like lasers.
You're trying to kill this for me, Andrew?
You had me. You...
They blow stuff up and there's laser blasts, but it's that kind of not sort of violent, like that violence that isn't violence in a way.
How's the animation quality, though?
About what you'd expect. So it's fine. Like, I feel like it's a fine attempt. My problem is, like, if I want the world of the movie, I'm more likely just to wait. I think if I was younger and still kind of hungry, like I used to be, like, if this is 10 years ago, I'm watching this cartoon guaranteed. Okay. But now I feel like I get enough other media presentations, and I know there's going to be another Guardians movie.
Right. But for a kid waiting 3 or 4 more years for another Guardians movie, forget about it. And for the kids who, you know, they sold the Guardians movie to kids, even though it's a PG-13 movie. And there are a lot of kids who know who the Guardians are, but there's no product for them. My almost 11-year-old really enjoys that, both that Agents of Smash Hulk cartoon and the Avengers Assemble. He prefers the Avengers Assemble one, really likes it. Even though I find it to be a little more vanilla than what I'd prefer, but I think they'll eat this up.
Oh, yeah, eat this up!
The Guardians one is replacing the Hulk one
because it reminded me quite a bit of this. I don't know if you guys are the right age. I watch cartoons way past the recommended ages, but the real Ghostbusters cartoon. In a way where they were trying to continue the franchise with the same characters, but it was just like a lighter version of it, because obviously they couldn't do what the movies did, nor did they have the kind of performances behind it. But that kind of, they captured the feel of the world in a cartoon way, and as a whatever age I was, which was way too old still, I was enjoying that. And I think if that's a good analog, and if you're in vibing on it, this, I would say, check it out. Like I said, the continuation had a good thing because that means that they might carry some type of continuity through the thing, which is always, in my mind, an improvement usually, because they can tell a little bit more better stories, and that's just my opinion. You guys can agree or disagree at will, but, and then at the end they re-showed the same.
I'm going to let it go unchallenged.
What? Well, I was going to say I liked Superhero Squad, so I think I've watched cartoons that were past the age where you're, you know.
I don't know what the heck you're talking about, but.
It was such a catchy theme, too.
Oh, yeah. We still have it on our iPods, and the kids listen to it.
All right, squaddies, time to hero up!
So, and we did a bunch of fun off-site stuff at San Diego, and Lego had a strong presence there. So there were all these Lego minifigs all over San Diego, and the part of town right next to the convention center is called the Gas Lamp, and it's just like restaurants and places like that. And Petco Park, the baseball park, is there. And so Nerd HQ, Nerdist, and Walker Stalker Con were all doing events in that area. So there were three other pretty good sized conventions going, plus all these little mini conventions. So you just kind of wander around and see all this really fun stuff. So we did that on Thursday. There's a park they call Petco Interactive, which had a giant inflatable Snoopy house. And so, you know, when Snoopy came out and worked the line, because the line got pretty long, and free food. And just, like, San Diego's this weird, it takes over the whole town. And
did you go and lay on your back on the top of the Snoopy house?
Well, the line was too, they had these slides, and they were giving away baseball caps. But I think because of the baseball caps, yeah, the lines just got down.
I need a bigger size.
You don't need a badge for that. It's one of those events. Like, some events you do, but that one you can just go to if you're a regular San Diego person hanging out.
If someone comes in here with a pinhead, I got to be on top of that.
So, and then we did do the Game of Thrones offsite experience for the first time, but that's not really very Marvel-y. Maybe a lot.
Any other Marvel action?
I think that was about it for what we're going to strictly call the Marvel end of the world. But I really, if you get a chance to go and you don't mind crowds, there's something immersive. My wife described it as kind of like the difference between Disneyland and Disney World. Like at the World, you're completely enveloped by the Disney, you know, if you're at the hotel and the thing. And that's San Diego, like all the hotels are themed that way and all the restaurants have, you know, superhero specials and the wait staff. Like at the hotel we were at, they were all wearing one day like Batman shirts and Captain America shirts. And they really, your key cards were all, I had a Teen Titans Go one. They had all the different, I think I had Starfire, and then there was, or the Warner Brothers TV shows, at least. So my wife got a Gotham one and everything. And it's just fun to have everything themed out that way. You know what I mean?
Very cool. We love Teen Titans Go. And you can hear other missives of Andrew's from San Diego Comic Con on the next episode of Indie Comic Book Noise, because we'll try to squeeze some more water out of the stone that was your experience at the con.
Not just that, but you can hear all the parts we can't talk about on Marvel.
Uh-oh.
The parts not for little kids.
Oh, boy.
Oh.
Baby snakes.
Late at night is when they come out.
I think we all saw a recent Marvel movie.
That we have. This is, week two of Ant-Man having been out in the theaters. How'd you see it, Andrew? Who'd you see it with? Did you see it with Lisa?
Yeah. Saw it with my wife. We go, we're big proponents of the weeknight movie. There is a movie chain next to us that has assigned seating. And I usually, at this time also, I usually go non-3D.
Yeah.
Myself, so those are as kind well. Of the rules.
How about you, Kevin? What was your movie-going experience like? What was your scenario?
What was my scenario?
How big of a group?
One person.
Just you, solo?
Just me. I went solo.
Nice.
Time.
No baggage.
Yeah. So it was like the first showing. It was like 4 in the afternoon. And,
nice.
And I'm sure there was, like, a lot of other things playing, or, like, 3D showings or Ultra AVX playing at the same time. So it was sort of, like, a spillover, right? Or people that don't want to see it in 3D. So it wasn't that full, and I got, you know, pretty much the seat I wanted. So it was good.
It came out when I was on vacation, so I saw it a week later and went on a Thursday night and took my almost 11-year-old son and four of his friends and one of their younger sisters went too, and a few of the other dads and another mom or two. So we had like a group of 12, a bunch of kids. So it was pretty entertaining. And when we finish chatting about it, I will share a short clip of the kids' reaction right after the movie that I recorded in the movie lobby theater. But for me, I really dug Ant-Man. I mean, I knew I was going to like the lead character because Paul Rudd's a likable actor and stuff. But the thing that surprised me a little bit and at the same time delighted me was the fact that it was like a caper movie. I love capers. I love the whole setup of a caper, the whole having the way that they did the hearsay of how they collected information about the caper, to the way that they filmed like the planning stages of the caper, to like the training for the different stages of the caper and everything. I love that in the movie, and I thought they really did it nicely here.
You know, I actually went to watch the trailer that I had never seen after I saw the movie, because I'm like, wait, what? And I'm like, yeah, you don't really get the sense that it's a heist movie from the trailer that I saw.
What I like about Marvel movies is, for my aesthetics, I think they really do a nice mix of the special effects, the fighting, the practical and digital, and the editing that makes it more palatable. Some modern movies can be cut kind of very quickly. Yeah. Such the extent that I feel it takes away from the action. But here I felt like I could really follow. I got a sense of the motion, and they did. I mean, they had to use more effects, obviously, because of the shrinking power of it. But some of the set piece fighting scenes I really enjoyed. And because I'm a tired old man, I can't say that about all modern action movies sometimes.
Well, yeah, they've fallen into the trap that music videos did, where it was like, we got to do a lot of cuts. From like one angle to another camera to another camera, and instead of just letting like the camera sit on the freaking guys playing the music so you can see them playing and see what the guitarist is playing, that kind of a thing, in the same way to cover up, you know, to sort of cheat in action sequences, they do all those lots of big cuts and it going so fast so you can't track what's going on. Here, it was, because it was a smaller film, the fights were of a smaller scale, and I thought that it was slowed down enough that I knew where everybody was and what they were doing, and maybe it's because of the fact that the power we're talking about here is shrinking, but like the working physics of the movie like worked for me too, as far as how mass was used and his powers and again how the fights were choreographed.
And they interacted with their environment in a fun way that you don't know that. I mean, I'm not going to say it was like fun like Jackie Chan level of excellence, but it was nice to see them use objects now that they're shrunk and integrate those into the action and fun and set pieces in a good way. I was like, yeah, that's what I want in an Ant-Man movie. I want him using weird objects and having them grow and shrink and himself grow and shrink while fighting another. I guess it's a minor spoiler. He fights a villain who also can grow and shrink.
And I also like the almost Zelig-like, you know, retroing him into the old, like, black and white archival clips where they show, you know, like, you know, military activity going on and some, like, invisible assailant, and then they zoom in and, like, it's pixely because it's digital and he's not supposed to be seen and it's at nighttime and it's a stealth operation, but you see his, like, little body there. And I thought that was all really done. Again, delightfully.
I thought the cast worked well together.
Oh my god!
I mean, it's going to be your feelings on Paul Rudd. Like, if you like him, you're going to like this. If you're bothered by him, you're going to be bothered by it. But I thought it was nice that they chose kind of a known commodity in a way that would help viewers be like, oh yeah, I think Paul Rudd has a lot of likability, but. And that shines through. But like I said, if I understand if you don't like him, I would not suggest watching this movie.
I didn't know who he was.
Can't. And he's likable enough, right? I mean, he can deliver the, you know, the comedy type lines and the soft lines, and he can be silent and look like he's being thoughtful at the same time. He's a good actor. Well, I thought it was like perfectly cast. Every role I thought was perfectly cast, from the Scooby gang, you know, like his friends and everything. They were hilarious. The Van Dyne girl, she was great. Douglas is Pym through the whole movie. I ended up liking him, even though he was like a gruff, tempered type guy. Like, everybody had even Ezekiel Stane was really good, or, you know, the guy who should have been Ezekiel Stane, the bad guy. For a non-superpowered villain, he was creepy, and you didn't know whether he was going to at any time kill the person who he was standing next to or pat him on the back. That's freaky. I thought it was really well cast. That was one of the things that really jumped out at me, that it was a smaller cast too. But yes. But every character I thought they hit it perfectly.
Kevin Paul Rudd, he does a lot of like comedies and romantic comedies. I would wager this is his first action-y oriented movie. So it was a bit of a reach. Just because you said you didn't know him. I've seen him in a lot of movies.
His first blip on the radar was he was a recurring character, one of the characters' boyfriends on Friends, one of the seasons, or maybe even two of the seasons. But that's where he first got his...
And I think he's been in some of the Apatow movies, too. Those comedies that he usually has some kind of role in, that type of thing, is like the... long suffer, like the nice guy boyfriend, but that kind of fun role. But yeah, I thought he did well, especially with the action movies. You know, he's not an action guy, and I thought the scenes didn't really suffer for having him be in it. It's not like they hired guy that does fight scenes all the time.
Just like Robert Downey Jr., you wanted a guy who was a washed up former addict type. Right, playing Tony Stark. You wanted a guy who was a softer guy who was in over his head with the physical and the action movie. That was the role, right? So I think in that the baby face works in that respect, I think.
My only knock would have been I probably would have trimmed a good random 10 minutes out of here or there. This thing clocks in at 2 hours. I think it's fine for a lot of people. I just feel like a lot of these ones, they just... Like, save that for the extended
DVD. Don't cut Garrett Morris's cameo, though.
No.
That was my favorite. That was my favorite cameo. Garrett Morris from Saturday Night Live, the original cast, makes his cameo. And you know why he was in it?
He was Ant-Man.
He was the first Ant-Man on film, on TV, in the old, when Margot Kidder was, right after the Superman movie. She was one of the guest host on Saturday Night Live, and they did the Lois and Superman cocktail party. Right, with John Belushi as the Hulk coming out of the bathroom and everyone like waving their hands, whoa, Hulk, you know. But Garrett Morris was Ant-Man, and he's there in this very well-designed Ant-Man costume, true to the comics that the staff came up with of Saturday Night Live, and they're all ribbing him for his powers.
Excuse me, I'm not sure if I remember your name. I'm really bad with names, you know.
You don't remember me? We met several times. It's Ant-Man. A-N-T-M-A-N.
Oh, right, right. Yeah. Ant-Man.
Oh, yeah.
What are your superpowers again? You talk to the ants, is that it?
Well, partly, but mainly I shrink myself down to the size of an ant while retaining my full human strength.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that's really impressive. The size of an ant with human strength. You must be able to clean house on those other ants.
Hey, Hulk,
hey. Check this guy out.
Ooh.
Got the strength of a human.
Ant-Man,
huh? Where are your ants? they're at home in the ant farm.
But he gets to be in the movie. I loved that. And Stan's cameos get better and better. The last two movies, they totally made me laugh rather than just, smile.
I also think they're good at... for me anyways, I thought the integration into the Marvel universe was the appropriate amount. It's clearly in there, and I'm not going to spoil it, but there's things that link it in, but it didn't feel like they were beating me over the head with it. It still felt like Ant-Man's story. They just made sure you knew when it was placed and where it was placed in a way that felt natural.
And while we do get a building blowing up, not necessarily concerned, but one of the aspects I was interested in going into this movie was whether Marvel could do a smaller movie that doesn't have helicarriers crashing into Capitol buildings and wormholes into outer space opening up with alien invasions passing through. And they did. You know, the action took place, you know, on a kid's train table for the most part, right? They really did pull it off. And like you said, the ties to the regular Marvel universe were really well done and set things up for the future too. And the metaphysical thing where they go into the subatomic realm and everything gets like real trippy and psychedelic, I thought that was done really cool too. I was visually entertained by that whole scene, and again, it could have been cheesy.
I agree.
2001 and, Space Odyssey there.
Yeah. Or the opening credits to Doctor Who, you know?
But even the building, they made it explode in a very – more imploded.
Right.
So it wasn't like a lot of debris, and they made a lot of scenes of people, like, taking people out of the building. Thought it was a really nice nod that they showed that, like, we're not going to ratchet up the body count in this thing anymore. I mean, people do die, but it didn't feel gratuitous.
The only thing that made it a PG-13 movie was they cursed a bunch of times.
Well,
you know, but other than that,
there was one kind of gruesome death. I don't want to reveal it, but the bad guy does do in someone.
Yeah.
In a particularly cold, as you say, you don't know if he's going to pat you on the back or give you the whammy.
Right.
And he gave the whammy. But I like I said, I would have just cut it down a little bit, maybe hour 45 or so, tighten up some of them scenes a little bit, make it feel like you're going, and it left room for the next movie, left room for the introduction of finally getting the Wasp into this stupid
thing. How cool is that?
I never understood why they couldn't get her in. It took this long, and I'm like, get her in there.
Well, Ant-Man, as soon as you got Ant-Man, you got the Wasp, right?
Yeah. Were they talking to the audience there? You know, and she says, finally. And I'm like, yes, finally.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool. Especially how they tease you with the Wasp as a legacy character along with Ant-Man, and her time was in the past. And I won't get more into that to spoil. But they had their time, Ant-Man and the Wasp. We just missed it. You know what I mean? But now it's like, no, we're going to get our Wasp. And I think Lily will be great in it. She was perfect.
Well, they demonstrated her competency at the skill set.
Yeah.
Like, she has the skills to perform the role.
Is that the first time Marvel's done something like, I don't want to spoil it, but it felt like it was something major that, like, I don't know if you could reproduce in a comic. Like, it was going off on, again, like, the movie stuff is sometimes it goes off in its own direction, and you're like, and I was really surprised.
Well, how long is it going to be before we get a Hope Van Dyne in the comics? I don't think it'll be long.
Well,
no.
Well, it would have been awkward if it was Hope Summers, let me just tell you.
Well, for me, it just opens up that they've embraced kind of the past, because I would totally, like I said, I enjoyed Agent Carter. I would totally have, if they wanted to do some kind of, find an actor that looks like a young Michael Douglas and do like the early adventures of Ant-Man and Wasp, I would watch a TV show of that or the
opening scene, the whole opening before the credits scene, instead of it being Hank Pym in the past quitting S.H.I.E.L.D., it was supposed to be a almost like a James Bond intro, like a whole separate adventure, and you got to see Elder Ant-Man in action rather than seeing it through the the stills and the clips the way that they did it. And apparently it was all filmed. And then they said, you know what, it just felt like it was, like you were saying, that they were looking for ways to cut it down. They said it felt like a whole nother movie, a whole nother scene, which that's how James Bond movies work, right? You get that whole other adventure at the beginning, and then that doesn't relate to anything that necessarily is coming up. The Simpsons do it a lot, used to do it a lot too. The whole opening scenes of The Simpsons would be hilarious, but it wouldn't really relate to what the whole rest of the episode was going to be. So that's on the cutting room floor, and maybe we'll get that in the DVD. But they were saying maybe we'll do one of those Marvel shorts or something and have it be like, you know, Hank Pym Sr. in action there, or Ant-Man Sr.
Yeah, I totally thought about the Agent Carter thing, and I'm like, you know.
Hmm. I just spent 10 years trying to keep this technology out of a Stark's hands. I'm not going to put it right back in another's. That was a great rationale for, like, why not call in the Avengers? Perfect.
The other thing is, I couldn't really detect the different hands in the soup, because it was a big deal when Wright left.
Yeah.
And I didn't, sometimes in movies, you know, it feels like there's almost two movies kind of fighting. I did not feel that. Whatever they did, I don't know whose contribution was what, if they scrapped everything or what they did. But to me, it didn't suffer from the idea of like, oh man, it feels like two, you know, it was going one way or
it felt like that came from an earlier draft or whatever. I thought the released product felt like a complete movie.
The most disappointing thing to me, honestly, was, and won't really reveal the spoiler of what it is other than what we all heard going in if we looked at all, which is that it relates something to tie into Civil War coming up. But the second after credits scene was very anticlimactic, and you know, no. I was like, all right.
I was gonna say it's a villain. I can totally understand like Marvel villains. Like, there's no like, oh, someone's greedy or someone hates this or someone likes money or whatever. Like, it's not hard to relate to that, but if they don't go beyond. I know it's a movie too, like, that's what makes, like, the Daredevil Netflix Kingpin so great. They spent all this time building him up. But in the Marvel movies, sometimes you get the simple motivation, but it's still easy to understand. But that would be my disappointment, even though I enjoyed the villain and everything.
Oh, wait, I have a slightly different take. And I'm just beating my head against the sand. I thought you meant visually. I thought the decision. He's very much a movie villain, and Ant-Man is pretty it's closer to the comics than anything other than the Vision, maybe. Or like, I like that they were trying to push, instead of the movies ruining the comics, I'd like to see the comics ruin the movies and push it more garish and interesting visual.
Well, who was Hank Pym's early, you know, villain? Was Egghead, right?
Well, like, I just thought it was Whirlwind. Come on, why isn't he in this movie? I knew I was going there.
That's fine.
I would, if Whirlwind showed up in that, I would have, you would have had to restrain me from standing up and hooting and hollering.
My my almost 11-year-old son said to me that, interestingly, there's only one Lego set that came from this Ant-Man movie, and it's the final battle with Ant-Man and the other villain who's wearing a suit. And so it comes with both those figures. It also comes with Hank Pym, but Hank Pym is in this stealth Ant-Man suit that we don't ever see in the movie. And I'm guessing that that's probably from that cut first sequence scene. But so that's kind of cool. You get a Ant-Man stealth. You get Michael Douglas in the Ant-Man in his Ant-Man suit in Lego form. All right, well, so you guys give it each a thumb up as well as I do?
Yeah, it was enjoyable. I thought it was one of the funnier Marvel movies. Marvel Studios, I guess I should say. I don't know where it will settle. I don't think it'll be, like, on the top, but it's kind of a weird realm we've gone into. It's like, well, we only had another good movie. Like, I'm sure a lot of companies, a lot of publishers, whatever industry would like to have that much success where you're like, well, that movie didn't pop. Like, the standard isn't that, oh, it's an average or whatever. It's like the average is like way too high. So you go, that was good.
This was actually because of the small scale aspect of it and it really seeming more like a comic booky Ant-Man type of adventure. I put it right up there with my favorite of the Marvel movies. It would be in my top five.
I don't know if it would make my top five. I would have to.
Sorry, Thor.
I think it would have to, like, battle, like, Guardians or something.
Guardians is there, too.
Because I don't know if Guardians even makes my top five.
Well, that's because your first five are the Roger Corman Fantastic Four.
Whoa, we're going all Marvel movies now?
No, just Marvel Studios. All right, let's hear what the kids had to say about it.
Can I ask you guys what you thought of the movie? Was it good?
Yes.
Yeah, everybody thought it was good?
Yeah. I thought the ant was a dog.
Was it, like, really good or just, like, good?
It was really good.
It was funny because Tom is so giant.
He just
got his eyes. Yeah. I just go, like, go back and forth.
And then the ant goes down the stairs and you're like, that's a weird dog.
Were any parts...
Whoops.
Were any parts too goofy, or was it just the right amount of goofiness?
No, it was the perfect movie.
Enough action or too much boring stuff before the action got going?
No,
it was
action-packed. It was cool to see how it changed.
That's true. And would you see it again?
Yes.
Would you tell your friends to see it?
Yes.
Is being 10 too young to see it, or were you guys all right?
I'm still 10.
I'm 11, so I'm the youngest, so yeah.
All right, and how old are you?
I'm 9.
All right. So that was good then?
Yeah, it was good. I think the age limit's like 8.
Yeah, right. I wouldn't watch it when you're too young because you get scared, but when you're too old,
and there's language.
All right.
There's a little
language in it. All right.
One word.
All right. Terrible. All right. Thanks, guys.
The multiverse was destroyed. Do life, Ralph.
We are back, Kevin, Andrew, and I, Steve Raker from the Comic Book Bunker, to talk about the Secret Wars, to give probably our penultimate big debriefing on all of the related number ones. There are a few that haven't come out yet, if you can believe that, as we're here in late July of 2015. But we have Secret Wars issue number 4 and as many as 13, a baker's dozen, a raker's dozen, if you will, of Secret Wars related number one tie-ins to cover here. Ready?
You know it.
Secret Wars number 4 of 8. And then I should say, we will, of course, cover how the Secret Wars series proper ends. But we've been committed to providing the listeners with the service of letting you know what the content of each of the issue number 1 tie-ins are, so you know if they cover some of the characters that you're interested in and whether you need to or would be interested in picking up some of the tie-in books, or know that it would not be something you're interested in, and help you navigate that minefield successfully. Secret Wars number 4 is written by Hickman, with art by Asad Ribic, of course, carefully working with Ive Sorcina, who handles the colors on his black and white painted washes.
And it opened, and we still have our cast of characters helpfully portrayed early on in the book, which is good. Good to keep up with who's who.
Yeah, when last we left the gang, we had the Thors encountering Thanos, our Thanos, and his Illuminati bunch who came out of the life raft unexpectedly, and the Thors have engaged, and things move on from there to the hidden isle of Agamotto, where Doctor Strange, Sheriff Doctor Strange, is meeting with our heroes, who he's had in the life raft of heretical materials that he has collected, that are heretical because they, you know, place doubt in the divinity of Doom and the history of the universe prior to the incursions. None of the people on Battleworld know of anything other than Doom, so that illusion has to be kept up. So Strange collects artifacts that would cause doubt, and he's had the raft with our heroes on it, our heroes who made it through: Cyclops, Spider-Man, the female Thor, Carol Danvers, Captain Marvel, Star-Lord, because there was a movie, and and Mr. Fantastic. And he's explaining to them kind of what happened and how he's bringing them up to speed. And in doing so, the readers are getting another opportunity to hear how things are. But we already know, so we're treated to the extra angle of hearing it from this Doctor Strange that you don't know if he is, being controlled by Doom or not. The way that he's talking, he makes the heroes feel pretty uncomfortable.
He's just looking out for everything. In Doom we trust, but then, he's probably doing some stuff that Doom wouldn't want him to do.
Well, he's got to provide sort of the balance
to Doom in a way. And also it explains, like, why we got here in a way of, like, why didn't Steven take the mantle himself? He's got to explain what a weenie he is. But what I liked was the return of the classic Spider-Man villain Razorback as a Thor.
Big hog-headed Thor.
I just wish, I didn't know where I wanted the big pig to come back. His tractor trailer.
Yeah,
I don't know if you remember. Like, come on, that would have been, you know, like a tractor trailer Thor thing. Like,
he pulls up to Doomguard.
beep, US beep. One.
Right.
Razorback. Yeah, that's a deep cut, but yeah, that's a Thor. There's a type of Thor that has a pig's head, but a human body, and he just reminded me of that funny Marvel Spider-Man villain. I don't know if that's supposed to be the same guy or not.
Because...
No, it's supposed to be Spider-Ham.
No, Spider-Ham lives on Spider-Island or something, doesn't he? Or not Spider-Island. He's in
Spider-Verse.
Yeah.
Spider-Verse.
I think I was really interested by everyone freaking out over Phoenix Cyclops again.
Well, right. Our Cyclops combined with the Phoenix power to try to go get through the incursion, to stop that last incursion and all that. So, because Strange is sheriff and a bunch of his Thors are being taken down by this, Dark Illuminati gang here, they teleport on site. So now we have the 616 heroes meeting the 616 villains who made it through on the various life rafts and fighting. And this gets brought to Doom's attention. And when he sees Richards, Reed, he says that he has been searching the multiverse for another version of him. And he hasn't been able to find one. And now he's stuck with two. Because the ultimate universe one is with the bad guys.
And that has a whole weird vibe for, because, he's using Valerie as his daughter in this.
And so Sue as his consort. She's calling Doom her love and everything. He's replaced Reed Richards. He's made Reed Richards' life his own in addition to making himself God.
It's all about Richards.
Always has been.
So, Doom, so what happens is the mechanism, I think it's kind of cool. These Thors, I guess, can pray to Doom and show up, and that was the boar-headed one that prayed, and that's how Doom was drawn awares to the situation.
When Doom shows up, there's a great confrontation. They don't jump to battling right away. So that you get some pretty civilized discussion, which is excellent. Reed plays things pretty cool. He's like, Victor, you've done an amazing thing here. You know, you're a miracle worker. And Doom shoots it right back at him. You must be one too. They're totally two fighters about to fight, dancing around the ring before the first punch is thrown, stalling and getting a read of each other, pun intended. And it's handled really nicely. And then, what were you saying about Phoenix Summers?
Well, I like the ultimate Reed joke too, where he's like, "Wait, is he talking to me?"
Oh, jeez. No, if anyone has the power, like, there's a lot of powerful guys, obviously, on Battle World. But I'm thinking like Phoenix Cyclops has got to be up there if anyone's gonna challenge Doom, and then Doom shows everyone that he is God. He is the Emperor. It's just not gonna go well for you.
I just think that it was one of these cases of no backup, though. Like, why was it just one? Why didn't they all jump in?
Because you know what happens, Steve. You one villain versus one hero, it's like evenly matched, and they always think, "Oh, let's get together," and then they end up shooting each other and everything, and it's actually worse than if you were one on one.
Well, Doctor
Doom wasn't trying to do any kind of evasive, like he's not Spider-Man. He's just standing there taking this it and dealing it back out. It's more like a heavyweight, like hit me as hard as you like. I'm just going to come back and give it right back to you, even harder than you gave it to me, so to speak.
I just think that if Strange could have come around and been like, this is our moment to take Doom and added his power to the rest of the gang rather than try to uphold the status quo in the face of, you know, all of his friends being here. Instead, he works some mumbo jumbo and quote unquote scatters them to the wind to live to fight another day, I assume. And
is Strange supposed to, like, take over Doom's place? Or what if they give it to someone else and they can't hold the whole thing together?
Well, maybe it's not one person's job. That's the whole... That's what man...
But we don't know if it even splits that way, like...
Well, the other thing is, I wonder if the Phoenix Force is done when he kills Cyclops or not.
It's the, like, Phoenix. Is that the end?
So... But you know what I mean? Like, did he absorb it? Did it go? Because clearly, Cyclops, I mean, they do as much as they can show to show that he doesn't get out of this battle.
Yeah, I really enjoy the give and take, the dialogue. That's where the strength is in this series, as much as the art is so beautiful and it's quasi-painted, you know, visuals. Hearing Doom and Strange talk and hash things out when you know that they both are the real caretakers of this realm, and then how the issue ends in a cliffhanger, I was like, wow, things are really happening here. They're not just building up this world anymore. Things are moving forward and things are falling apart.
Yeah. Well, you don't say certain things to Doom.
I was really surprised
how, I don't know, Steve, I think you touched on something. Like, it seemed like a weird half measure that Strange does. Like, what does he, I don't know, I guess he feels he could talk to Doom out of it. Like, he feels they're peers or, I don't know, it seemed like a gross, but they're not in any way. Like, he must know he's the subordinate far and away. They're not peers in any way.
But if this isn't the time, then when? I mean, Cyclops had the mask melting off his Doom's face, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
But
can you imagine if Cyclops was, like, running, like, Battle World after this or something like that? I'd just be like, I wonder how much.
A new AVX.
Would change.
A new Secret Wars tie-in number one, AVX.
I guess. The only thing I would have preferred was... It seems like when they were showing some of the punch-ups, a lot of it was sort of off-panel-y. And I thought maybe we could have had a bit more, give us a little taste of the more kind of... There's an element of that that I like in my comics. I like a little punch-up once in a while, you know? Like, don't have it be kind of the... Like, people watching the fight, in a way, was how we were doing it. Because, you know, it's like Doom spying in on the fight or Valerie summoning. And, like, get us in there. Let us... Watch. I want to see Thanos take out a few Thors, you know?
It's also not the case, though, that like some of the tie-ins in the 90s and beyond, where you see a fight start and then you got to go to other comic to read that fight.
Yeah.
That isn't the case either, though. The tie-ins aren't doing that. So when something happens off-panel, it really does happen off-panel.
I'm sure we'll see a lot of punch-ups before this is over anyways.
Well, I'm just saying, for Uncle Andy's sake, let's get some punch-ups, man. It's Secret Wars. They gotta be.
I need content, though. I need those conversations.
Yeah, but if you want that, we can just have the novelization of this thing.
But then I have no pictures to look at.
That's funny. All right. Let's take a look at some of these tie-in books. You want to go alphabetically, Andrew, so that we can be friendly
That's
with
how
your
I
list?
Had it. Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, it just made it a convenient way. Although I did notice we've shined one series out of this whole thing that we've... I don't think we've talked about it. And I don't know if we should. Maybe we shouldn't talk about it.
Well, I know which one you're talking about. The Scotty Young one?
Yeah, it's one I didn't pick up. I just didn't have any interest in the little AVX Battle World thing.
Yeah, it really isn't tied in. It really isn't a domain on Battleworld, is it?
I don't know. I was like, I liked it okay, but it wasn't a world that I felt I needed to go back to. Yeah. Although there's something funny about little cartoon characters proclaiming by Doom or whatever.
Oh, yeah, fighting. It's fun.
But yeah, it wasn't. So apologies to Marvel Noise listeners. I shined my duty in buying that one, but it just wasn't my thing.
All right, 1872, number one. This is written by Jerry Dugan with art by Nick Varela under an Alex Maleev cover.
And colors by Lee Loughridge.
They give us wonderfully a map of the Valley of Doom territory in the beginning, which is cool. I liked the drum and drum as Undertakers, personally, the Brother Voodoo nod.
Murdoch Nelson and Owsley. So they're all teaming up as the attorneys in the town. Like, doesn't that seem like a difficult group to get work together? Now, the one that I thought was interesting was the Starnes Savings and Loan, right next to the Starks. Like, the Starnes. And Emrah Rambeau is in this. So the original female Captain Marvel.
This is the Western book. Ben Urich narrates the tale from the township of Timely by the river that's now all dried up after its flow has been diverted to facilitate Roxxon's mining interests. And Fisk founded the town as a hero, but now he is like the villainous mayor. So it's got all of the components of a good Western town, right?
Well, and you also have the drunk hero. That's Stark.
Yep. And Steve Rogers is the idealistic sheriff. And how the story goes kind of in issue one is he interrupts the lynching of Red Wolf, who was going to blow up Roxxon's dam. And
just starving off the land, not only the land for the town, it's creating problems for the town as well as the reservation.
And Rogers isn't against Red Wolf getting his due, but that's just it. He wants him to get his due process. So he wants to hold him. Fisk wants Red Wolf for himself. He sends all his bad guys to try to get him, and Rogers is going to have to try to maintain his version of the law. I like the mention of the slain deputy Barnes. I thought that was a nice touch, you know?
Yes, I'm for the henchmen, one guy was definitely giving me a like Crossbones vibe because he's wearing the white desk mask.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought maybe the guy with the mustache might be a Batroc little nod. There's not enough in it to give that. Just my own personal like. Oh, for me, that guy is the Batroc analog. Because, you know, he's fighting Steve Rogers.
Yeah, at the end, the governor is Roxxon of this territory, I guess. So they send enforcers to come down to this little town to set Rogers straight, basically. And their group of enforcers looks like it's Bullseye, Elektra, the Owl. And not sure the other guy, maybe Kraven? But he's the red beard, or...
The one guy does look like the Owl, but there's already an Owsley in the town, is why I was like, that's weird. That's what kind of confused me about, is that Owsley or not? I thought the guy in the back might... Maybe that's Razorback. It's like a mountain man guy wearing a bear's skin draped over him. But yeah, Kraven would be a fine guess, I think.
But it's a basic sheriff standing up for the law against the establishment and putting himself at risk type of Western vibe. My favorite little moment is Drunk Tony's mechanized hidden wrist gauntlet isn't a weapon that comes out, but he's modified it, and it's like a little emergency flask at the time of the firefight. That is a good little moment of comic relief.
Hey, everyone needs their secret weapon. And another character that we'll mention later appears, Turk, is here, and he's also in another. Oh, wait, we're not covering that book anymore. Turk shows up in Armor Wars, too. So if you like all these analogs showing up different places, you'll see plenty of them. Turk is a classic Daredevil low-level minion that Daredevil always beats up for information.
Age of Apocalypse, number one. Written by Fabian Nicienza with art by Gerardo Sandoval. And Sandoval provided a giant gatefold cover that if you were able to either procure or see online, it was quite a piece. Really nice job.
Yeah, it's certainly evocative of and David Curiel is the colorist. The art in here is very stylized, we'll say.
It's Sandoval is.
A fun, like this weird mishmash of, like, to me it reminded me of like video game art.
Well, remember the original Age of Apocalypse was during the Joe Mad era of X-Men, so I think a lot of that vibe was intended to be carried through, but I think Sandoval hasn't looked better. It looks really good.
It does. The thing I like, the video, not only are the misproportioned, exaggerated physiques, but the hair. Everyone's got crazy hair. Either it curls in a weird way, it's too long, or like, you know, Wolverine has his even spikier than it normally is.
That's
or
if that
it's
Joe Mad, Roger Cruz look, you know? Sure.
And it was just, I wouldn't want more than one book of this a month, let me be clear, but it made me laugh a few times. That's worth something.
This has Baron Nur, Apocalypse, leading this domain. And Magneto has taken over Xavier's mission to thwart Baron Nur. And the Savage Land is being used as a hideout. It's like a seeming oasis where humans and mutants can try to live and coexist together. Well, Holocaust, Baron Nur's son, one of the original characters created for the Age of Apocalypse that then crossed over into our universe when that event ended, along with the Sugar Man and X-Man, Nate Summers, Nate Gray, I should say.
You're speaking my language now.
The Holocaust, he comes and he gets all holocaustic and he blows like the whole Savage Land up, including himself.
They say that they can't find it. You know, they 2,000 square miles were destroyed and they couldn't find any trace of him. Like, there was nothing. Now, so presumably he's gone.
Kevin, didn't this seem like this all takes place in the Age of Apocalypse world prior to the Age of Apocalypse event? Like, it's before, you know, there is no Nate Gray yet or X-Man yet or any of the thing. You know what I mean? Like, if you think about it from the Age of Apocalypse side of things, it seems like this is pulled from before the events we've seen portrayed already, doesn't it? Or no?
Yeah, well, I guess you can take it from wherever you wanted to, but it's probably better to take it from earlier because, you like, know, it gets weird that...
Like, you think Scott has met Jean yet? I don't. You know what I mean?
It's altered, though, because of the world and the characters, and I was just kind of wondering if they would call Holocaust, because when they sold the figure to kids, they called him Dark Nemesis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, so, he's called Holocaust in this one from...
Yeah.
Mommy, I want a Holocaust for my birthday.
You, what? That's it. I'm writing a letter to Marvel. That's offensive.
So is that Age of Apocalypse? Is that on the Marvel Unlimited? Is that something I need to go look up?
It's very reprinted, so I wouldn't be surprised if it was.
Yeah, I have the Omnibus. And they're putting out new trades again in a different reading order again. So.
There was so much content to that.
It's so good though. Like it has everything you want. Like it has the crazy maps and the alternate world stuff. And
what I've liked better is in later on when they've revisited it with shorter, smaller projects. Like they did a little Tales of Age of the Apocalypse that was like a little prestige square bound. Maybe it was a one-shot or maybe like a four-issue limited series or something. Or occasionally they do a little revisitation, and I've enjoyed those. But like you said, I couldn't read more than a book a month about this. That was the problem with Age of Apocalypse to me. It was too much of a world that I didn't really want to get into. It was pretty depressing, and
I really wanted to get into that. I remember going to stores trying – like I was reading, I don't know, maybe a few X-books, and I was trying to get everyone during that event. And I was just like, yeah, give me as much as you
can. Oh, I got it all. I got it all and read it all.
So is the omnibus everything? I'm looking at it's like 1,000 pages. Does that seem like it's all of it, or
no? It's not the bare bones. I would say it's the main story. It doesn't have some of the extra stuff on the fringes that is kind of unrelated. Like, it's kind of crazy to say it's over 1,000 pages and it's the main story and it doesn't have everything, but that is the main story.
Crazy.
Well, did they come out with a second omnibus then?
No, but they did the complete trades before the omnibus, and then I guess they figured the omnibus would just be too big if they had all this, like, extra filler material or whatever.
I might have to ask for a Kevin Lee list.
It's kind of a big story, and I'm kind of impressed and amazed because at that time, like, the X-Men is like one of the top books, and then you say, "Hey, we're canceling the X-Men and doing this." Well, like, that's pretty incredible.
Yeah, I mean, they replaced each title with one of these, you know, other related titles, as if now we're in the Age of Apocalypse, and these are what the comics would be like. And it was clever. It was fun.
Well, maybe I'll, like I said, if it's on the Marvel Unlimited, maybe Kevin can cook me up.
I didn't care for that version of Jean Grey. I didn't care for that version of Scott Summers. I didn't care for that version of Wolverine. Magneto was pretty cool, but there was just too many characters. The Sugar Man was, I didn't like him. I didn't like the Dark Beast. Why would they call him the Dark Beast if he was the only beast from there? Like,
Comics. It was just having fun.
Nate Grey, I didn't like him either.
But there was some sort of, I guess since I haven't reread a lot of it, but it seemed like it was a higher quality because it was contained for one thing and it was going somewhere at that time. So
yes, contained in 1,300 pages.
Well, it was very well executed. It was because that's
rather than like, hey, who's the third Summers brother? I don't know. That was an editorial mistake. Maybe we'll get to it in 20 years. Like, compared to that type of continuity, the Age of Apocalypse was like extremely coherent.
And I don't think they came up with new titles during the Age of Apocalypse event. It was after, when they added the X-Men. But, Andrew, that's how big the X-Men publishing side of the company was. If you replaced every ongoing X-book for 3 months or 4 months with a different title, that's how much content you got. Three or four months of X-Men comics was 1,300 pages at that time of the Marvel publishing. It's crazy.
And the things he did were like cool to like a kid. Like, hey, you lob off Wolverine's arm. Like, you might think, oh, that's lame or that's so 90s. But when at that age, you're like, yeah, this is awesome. Oh yeah, he's got lit on fire. He's missing an arm and, oh, he's with Jean Grey or whatever. Like, that was just, and you knew it wasn't, even then I knew it wasn't going to be forever, but it was like a cool thing.
Well, so now we got the Age of Apocalypse established. In this Age of Apocalypse number one here, how it ties in with what's going to tie into the Secret Wars business is the deal seems to all revolve around Doug Ramsey, Cypher. He is being sought after by the bad guys, and he's to be protected by the good guys, to keep it simple. Destiny, one of the second wave of Brotherhood of Evil Mutants there, who used to hang around with Mystique and stuff and saw the future, she's got a prophecy that he's, like, really important and vital to the overthrow of Apocalypse or something big in the future. So, everyone's after him. The bad guys don't know what role he's going to play, but they should probably take him out, and don't know why everyone else is trying to protect him, and the good guys just know they need to protect him for something. We get to see yet another Essex, Mr. Sinister. I don't know how many Mr. Sinisters we've seen so far here on Battleworld, but there's been a few.
And another one was revealed in an existing series of ours, so yeah, he's all over the place.
And we get a visit to a human ghetto, because in the Age of Apocalypse, the mutants rule. Professor Xavier was killed and a long time ago, so his dream was never fought for. So we get a human ghetto that's patrolled by Peter Corbo, because he is a scientist related to the X-Men universe. And a very S.H.I.E.L.D.-garbed-like Sheriff Carol Danvers. And the whole issue ends in a big confrontation again, over Cypher, over Doug Ramsey, and he realizes by quite literally reading between the lines that there may be a mutant-killing virus being produced, and he gets stuck with the, should I speak up? And, you know, the good guys, the oppressed, will be totally wiped out, and the status quo will be maintained, and I'll be killed, or do I, keep it to myself? He's stuck. He's stuck with a catch-22. People are going to die either way.
That's so 90s, too. A mutant-killing virus.
Yeah, exactly.
So you guys, so this Burner character is from the Age of Apocalypse. He was a neat design, all fire, kind of Dormammu meets...
Yeah, I didn't remember him, honestly.
Yeah, I think they added some things.
So he'll probably die.
Yeah.
And there was also an elf lady with knives at the on the last
she's
page.
She's Blink.
No.
She's Blink. She's purple.
Oh, this version of Blink. Okay. I didn't, for some reason.
That's the other thing to remember about the Age of Apocalypse. Like, she was supposed to be in Generation X, then they killed her off. She was a nobody. And once they introduced her in Age of Apocalypse, she was like a breakout star.
And I did like that there's a whole Summers clan, and they're all idiots and everything like that part. I don't know. It's very, the two of the Summers brothers felt like the video game franchise kind of Gears of War. Like these ridiculously overproportioned military-looking dudes in it. Very video gamey. So maybe I'll check out Age of Apocalypse, the Marvel Unlimited version. That was the main title, was called Age of Apocalypse?
There wasn't a main title.
Oh, okay.
It was only all of the X... There was an X-Men Prime and an X-Men Omega that started it and ended it. And then all of the ongoing titles were replaced with... I think it was even same creative teams. They just changed what it was, and that's what the event was. And they all had the tie-in banner, Age of Apocalypse. But there was no Age of Apocalypse series until years later when, again, they were revisiting. I think they had an Age of Apocalypse series then, and a mini and a Tales from the Age of Apocalypse and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, I think there was an Alpha, Omega, and Prime was like sort of like setting up the Marvel Universe. Well, X-Men side of the Marvel Universe, because you could read the X-Men, not the Avengers or whatever, and you know, you didn't really have to read anything else at Marvel.
Well, they were specifically having Marvel's editor groups be different families. Remember, they even had different like trade dress for like the Fantastic Four group of titles, the Spider-Man group of titles, the X-Men group of titles, the Midnight Suns, you know?
And they even had, like, they had so many titles, too. They even had a book for, like, the Marvel Universe. So if you wanted to see what happened to Bruce Banner in a world where Apocalypse took over and everything, I'm like, yeah, you could see that.
All right, let's keep this train moving, though. Yeah, Age of Ultron versus Marvel Zombies number one. Carlos Pacheco cover and written by James Robinson and Steve Pooh.
With Jim Charlampidis doing the color.
This is our all-new Invaders team. I wonder how that's going to tie in. This title takes place in the Deadlands beyond the Shield Wall that cuts off the southern pole of Battleworld, where all the bad stuff goes down. Tigra, she has been exiled to her death over the wall for her part in a failed coup against her realm's baron. First, some Marvel zombies show up and make life difficult for her, until a wave of perfection-seeking Ultrons show up and blast them to smithereens.
I really liked what I thought, and I don't know if it's more the colors or the art, but it felt like the art shifted, and it's really cool. Like, the opening pages have kind of a dark... felt more like the zombie series, but then when they shift to talk about the Ultron, like, it suddenly lightens up on the page and everything. And I really like the feel of that as it shifts and explains what's happened on the Ultron side. I was like, that's really clever. Like, I think the whole team is doing a really cool job of creating the different feels of these different worlds.
The domains. We get this history of the Ultron world, the Ultron part of Battleworld, perfection, how it how it came to be. In this reality, Ultron killed Hank Pym, like, the moment he was first turned on, when he still looked, had, like, the vacuum cleaner, look with the, you know, office chair wheels.
The angry vacuum cleaner look.
Angry vacuum cleaner for sure.
That was still the creepiest Ultron from that movie, too. Something about that.
He soon took over the rest of the world, all the heroes and everything. And then we shift scenes to the wall itself, where we get a tinkerer Hank Pym from the town of Timely in the Valley of Doom, from our 1872 title. We saw what Tony Stark was the drunk and Steve Rogers was the sheriff. Here is the Hank Pym. He was a tinkerer, had his own little town shop, but he tinkered too much. And he is now being sent over the wall to his death. Apparently, they mentioned something that alludes to maybe he collected too much adamantium in one spot, and Doom doesn't allow for that. So we've got derby-wearing Hank Pym from Aw-Shucks 1872 over the wall, and he encounters some zombies, and then kind of gets a encounter with some individuals that are really going to interest him.
I also liked how this is the first time we see someone get a choice of, like, what crappy part of the wall are you going to go to. I thought it was a nice choice of storytelling. They do like this kind of panel tree because it's a lot of dialogue, but by breaking it up and sort of the panels expand down, I thought it made it visually a bit more interesting. Although had a little bit of confusion. Sometimes I get panel order out of order. But that was a really cool way to be like, okay, we're going to do a huge info dump about all these realms and what Pank did and everything. And they just knock it out in this big double page spread. And Pym, of course, takes the Ultron land. Because he was that.
Yeah. The reason why we have the all-new Invaders team is because at the end he runs into the original Human Torch, Jim Hammond, and the Vision, and Safari Jacket Wonder Man.
All right. And they bail Christmas him out of the fire because old-timey Hank Pym is not a fighter.
I like how we're learning more and more about what's going on down in the Deadlands and on the other side of the shield. This is cool. I mean, that's the unexplored territory.
And I just thought that, like I mentioned before, the art team is really knocking out with the feel and changing it around and moving it and nice storytelling choices. Like, all in all, I you know, this is top notch. But I understand if you have zombie fatigue, then you wouldn't want this. But I don't know. I feel like they're just an element of it. It's not like it's all just zombies and they're not redoing the same jokes. I mean, there's always going to be a bit of a joke about the zombies, but it's more than that in this element of it.
Captain Britain and the Mighty Defenders, number one, written by Al Ewing, with art by Alan Davis and Mark Farmer. I gotta say, as much as I like Alan Davis and Mark Farmer, it's a pretty unimpressive for an Alan Davis cover. Maybe good for somebody else, but it was like, ho-hum, colors and composition, both.
Yeah, I'm with you. It's just a team, and they're all kind of looking out at us. They could have done something a bit more dynamic. Just because, I mean, when you have a talented group like that, who've done so many covers, you would think. But I wonder if there's some, I don't know, rule about how you do it or whatever. I don't know. Will Quintana is the colorist on this book.
The twist of this reality is that in this domain, Tony Stark, upon creating the Mark I Iron Man armor in the cave, sacrificed himself and put Dr. Yinsang into the suit, saying that the world needs a healer, not another sword maker. And it turns out, with a great result, right? It's like the world is years later. It's a philanthropic utopia. But then the incursion comes, Kevin. Dun, dun, dun. What are you going to do with your philanthropic utopia now?
Although what's weird is this is the only Thor that it's a She-Hulk who's not Thored out.
Well, she's pretty buff.
She looks like her.
Yeah.
And the only thing in her hammer is a gavel.
That's clever.
Like a judge's gavel.
That's clever, nodding to her lawyer role. But so now we have this realm post-incursion. He's Baron Yinsen now. And his Thor is the She-Hulk, as you say. But he's having these dreams, this history of Tony Stark giving his life up and giving him the armor and all that. As we read that, it turns out that that was a dream that the Baron was having. He's having visions from before the incursion. This is heretical. Jen Walters, their Thor, is willing to let it slide, but as she leaves, she admits to herself she's had dreams too. And so has Hobie Brown, who is their Prowler Spider-Man type. He's having visions of Spider-Verse.
Yeah, the whole fabric, and as in we've seen in other of these titles, sort of the Doom's conceit is kind of cracking.
Then Dr. Fazia Hussein, who is a Captain Britain, all decked out in white with a white cloak and a big sword, obviously, enters the scene from a neighboring territory within the same domain, I believe, as I am to understand it. But perhaps it's a neighboring domain altogether. Her entrance is heresy in of itself, and she's speaking heresy, and She-Hulk is like, all right, I'm not going to enforce this. This is, I have to agree. And then boom, Doom shows up, strips She-Hulk of her rank, and then allows an invasion to happen from a neighboring domain, and Yinsing is killed. And it seems like the neighboring domain, we're only getting a glimpse that it, you know, it looks like it could be like Punisher Town or something.
It's very Thunderbolts. It felt Boss Cage. We're getting that little dip that we had in that, which I don't think we're ever going to get to on the Thunderbolts segment, but maybe it was Dark Avengers by then. But if you remember that, when they go to that world, it's the Boss Cage, because they're all calling them bosses. And that is just a 2000 AD knockoff.
Yeah, a lot of people, I think, I've seen some comments like, oh, like, yeah, I guess they're just doing a direct Judge Dredd thing and everything. Because, you know, it's Secret Wars in the canon, and then I'm like yelling through the iPod saying, you didn't read Thunderbolts then.
Right.
Well, but to be fair, they're both true. I mean, it is from Thunderbolts, but that thing is still a 2000 AD knockout. Like, you know.
Yeah, but they're both true. It's not like it's like brand new. It's like,
No.
Yeah, they did, like, it's actually referencing another, you know, another Marvel book.
You know, in some way, though, I feel like it didn't get any more 2000 AD Judge Dreddy than the next book, which is Civil War number one.
Although, one question for both of you before we move on. Magna Conti? Is that someone I'm supposed to know? But one of the incursion from the 2000 AD realm, there's an Emma Frost, Boss Frost, there's a War Machine who's comically like a giant human tank, but there's one of the characters that's Magna Conti, and I just didn't recognize that name, and I didn't know if you're like, oh no, Andy, that was Tony Stark's brother from whatever, or if you guys knew who that character is supposed to be.
It's not Magma?
Well, it's a guy, and he's, you know, it's a big buff dude wearing the armor, and he's one of the bosses, but I just couldn't tell if Magna Conti, maybe that was I don't know, one of the real name of Paladin or something like that.
No, I don't know. Civil War number one, I was not really looking forward to this tie-in because as much as the original series brought a lot of readers back to comics and got a lot of attention and was very successful and all that, there was so much mischaracterization in that storyline that it really rubbed me the wrong way as a ongoing monthly reader. So Civil War doesn't bring up the best feeling and taste in the back of my mouth, let's say.
Hey, as long as the heroes are fighting heroes instead of stopping the villains, you'll be like, all right, they did it right.
I'll tell you, though, this book was really cool. The whole premise and everything. I really enjoyed it. Written by Charles Soleil, with art by Lin Liu and Jerry Allen Gulen. The Superhero Registration Act that was part of Civil War. The whole superhero Civil War itself between Iron Man and Captain America. In this reality, it never ended. All right. Hostilities resulted in huge collateral damage of like $15 million when the events are intense. An explosion that gets carried from the negative zone prison into our world on Earth via a teleportation incident with Cloak. And oh, it's crazy. But after that, things start falling. Osborn takes over. Throws a coup on the U.S. government, so we get like a Dark Reign kind of world, but that doesn't last. Osborn gets toppled, and the country is basically split into two. On the East Coast, you've got the Iron, and that's Iron Man's rigid, structured police state full of laws and all that. And on the West Coast, you've got the Blue, which the laws are, I think there's only two. Don't hurt people and help people when you can. Or the Punishers come.
Why am I thinking of like Hickman's East and West now?
Yeah, right. So we get in this first issue of Civil War a glimpse of operations in each territory and get an idea of how things go. There's one bridge made of mechanical pieces of St. Louis that bridge across a giant crevasse that separates the country, and the two sides, the Blue and the Iron. And the nation is literally split in half of this great divide. And this issue is taking place years later. People have gotten used to this as being the status quo. And peace talks are being initiated. Tony and Steve, Iron Man and Captain America, they agree to meet. They argue. And then the peace talks totally fall apart, and the war is back on, kicked into high gear, and the issue ends. So things are going to get intense and big, I think.
I thought Sonny Go on colors did a really good job. I think the book is pretty.
Yeah.
Pretty and fun to look at. I'm kind of with you. Like, I don't really like jerk Captain America, which we get in spades here. So it makes it kind of like, I would have just assumed they picked some other character than Cap, because I don't really think of him as a jerk. And also, what perpetuates the situation, they make it clear that both sides get wrong information. But I'm not really sure if that's going to be the reveal at the end of how they did, because each one thinks the other one did the really nasty thing that killed all those people.
Right.
And I'm like, that is that going to get a payoff later on, or is that just
doesn't
it, or doesn't a pretty key point?
Yeah, but it might be one of these things that's lost in the annals of history that like neither of them were wrong, you know what I mean? And that happened, but yeah, I don't know.
So I was curious about that part. Like, is that going to get a payoff? I think it looked pretty, like you, Steve. This world is of less interest to me, so revisiting it wasn't quite the same. But I'll probably plow along and see what happens. I don't know. It's an Elseworlds tale. Tony Stark can be a fascist and Captain America can be a jerk.
E is for Extinction, number one. Under an Ian Bertram cover. Written by Chris Burnham. Wait. Written by Chris Burnham.
Yeah.
Interesting. And art by Raymond Villalobos.
With colors by Ian Hearing?
Think Morrison Quietly era X-Men here. It's 10 years after Xavier killed himself to stop Cassandra Nova, as he threatened to do at one point in that run. She was in his head. He threaten to off himself, and does. So Magneto has taken over the idea of a school. It's now an academy for exceptionals, human and mutant alike. Scott and Emma, they live in the old Gray Malkin Lane X-Mansion, but they're kind of like old, fat outcasts, old-timers with old, failed ways, still hanging on to their old dream or whatever, questioning their existence and their, you know, whether they matter or not. And mutants are accepted as how mankind is going to evolve. Humans are even paying to have, like, random X genes in their kids' DNA activated to keep up and be competitive with the neighbors and that kind of a thing, which was a kind of an interesting angle.
Well, the human race is
Magneto does let people at his, let humans flat scans at his school if you're exceptional.
Yeah, right. Logan, he's a barfly. I like that they joke that he's like tall now, which I, as a second, they're like, hey, what is that? Your secondary mutation that you're tall now, which I thought was a funny, knock on them trying to tie the Wolverine character to be more like the movie Wolverine at the time, who obviously isn't a runt.
Well, I also like that they make a joke about how Wolverine really is kind of crazy. I thought that was good humor at various points in this book, kind of making fun of some of the tropes of the X-Men in general. Like, so you need to have a good... And I don't know how that's going to clash with the more dramatic elements of it. You know what I mean? Like, I would have been happy with them just going more for the jokes. Mm-hmm. So I'll be curious to see that balance.
Well, things are all set up now. That world is established. And what happens is that Cyclops and Logan have to meet because they learn that Magneto, and correctly so, they learn that he has a comatose Jean Grey alive. She was in mental contact with Xavier the moment that he shot himself. And she's been in a coma ever since. But this coma, she's inside this big, like, stasis cocoon type thing. So old, irrelevant Cyclops and Logan are going to have to get their mojo back and act to see if they can go save Jean, I guess. Oh, and you can't have a Morrison run without Zorn.
Is that how you pronounce it?
How did you pronounce it?
I don't know. It was just always confusing. It was one of those things, because even though the internet was around during the Morrison run, obviously, it was just, it's an X.
All right.
Next. Yeah, I'm not super familiar with that era of X-Men, but I felt like great I era. Could slide right in and pick it up, and it was like, oh yeah, this feels like, you know, the type of thing that works out well. I'm down with it.
Yeah.
It's good. It's fun, weird.
That was like new Marvel, and that was like rescuing the X-Men from what it became in the 90s.
So you're okay, even though I guess it's disgracing the Age of Apocalypse era. Kevin, you're all right with a 180 turnaround?
There's quite a gap between Age of Apocalypse and the Morrison run. And then just before, like, Morrison comes on board, it's like Scott Lobdell returning again to write the X-Men. You're just like, Claremont returning for the third time, and you're just like, oh man, are they ever going to get someone like new that's going to like do the,
yeah,
like the next generation type of thing? And it's like, yeah, that was Morrison.
It brought Emma in as an X-Man. It introduced the idea of the secondary mutation with her like diamond ability. It reopened the school and had a whole bunch of new characters and new mutants that are still popping up in, you know, like the Jason Aaron Wolverine in the X-Men book and that kind of stuff. There are a lot of angles there that have really stuck around that have been maintained since that run.
Yeah, just have to get used to the Quietly artwork because, first exposure and you're like, at first you're like, whoa, what is going on? But well, it's good.
It was also Iger Cordy, who was also took some getting used to, but Vince Skyver did some good stuff on those issues. I thought I liked his fill-ins.
Yeah, some
subliminal messages in there.
Indeed.
Also a good use of a silent issue that actually has a few words on the first page and the last page, but yeah.
All right, The Guardians of Nowhere, number one, written by Brian Michael Bendis with art by Mike Diodato. Nowhere. It's a city in space. I see stars, too. I don't know if... Was that an accident?
They talk about traveling in space, and so I guess in this part of Doom, that's not heresy or something?
But they're talking about it to match... Like, they're talking about Nowhere as a legend... So I'm wondering, well, no, but they wouldn't have a legend of stars because the people don't even know of stars right. Other than it as a symbol. So, yeah, I don't know what the deal is because I thought there's supposed to be no stars. But Nowhere is a city inside the severed head of a celestial that Lord Doom killed.
Doom!
And it's, we're going to get some Angela action in this. And I thought this one...
I like more.
I thought Diodato and with Colors of Frank Martin, it was a strong, kind of fun, that type of artwork. This is a well-represented batch of it. It didn't feel rushed or anything, and good composition, good storytelling.
I like Diodato quite a lot.
And it's getting the band back together. That's this issue, which seems to be a popular Guardians story. Like, you don't know what to do, just have the first issue be they're all getting together.
Yeah, Angela fights Drax. She's hunting Gamora, who has committed a heretical and forbidden act by leaving their territory, Nowhere. And the Guardians assemble, and Gamora professes her doubt, like, in the existence of Doom at all. She says he's just a myth that is used to keep us in line. So Nowhere has no real... concept of what the reality is on Battleworld, just as Battleworld has no sense of Nowhere, which is interesting. There's a big existential argument among the team. Thanos gets mentioned, and at the end of the ish, they're attacked by some Yotat named Yotat.
Yeah. I always think that's one of those names that you're like, it's so close to like meaning something backwards or what, you know what I mean?
Yeah, right.
Like, you just feel like that should... like Tobor or something, like you're right there, like that should spell something if I move the letters around or whatever.
You have to think about it for a second when you first see it. Are they going for something there? The same thing with Magna Carta there or whoever you said before.
Yeah.
Or the Del Rusk. I think that one out.
In Yotat. And I do love the cartoonishly oversized shoulder.
Yeah.
Like, I understand the skulls with the horns, but these things look like it would be impossible to make any kind of strategic moves or whatever. Like, that this one is definitely a lot of, between Angela and him, it's the land of, like, impractical battle outfits, but that's not going to stop you anyway. So Angela is the Thor of the realm, which must make her even more formidable, I would think. Because I think being a Thor, like, ups your power level to begin with.
Oh, yeah.
Cool explosion. Yeah, I think for me, I just sort of cut this out of that whole there's no space, there's no stars, and just said this is another part of Battle World, and other people are unaware of it, and it's kept separate. Yeah, you got to have a little bit of double think sometimes to reconcile all these. Either that or you just don't read it next to the Carol Core one.
Hail Hydra.
Hey, now that this one's really interesting.
No, I meant Hail Hydra.
I think it's like the Punisher one.
Rick Remender and Roland Boschke.
Yeah, the same guys that did that Winter Soldier, Bitter March limited series.
Under an Andrew Robinson cover. This is the United Confederation of Hydra. Hydra founded New York and is run by Arnim Zola, and the peace is kept by a massive Hydra police force.
You missed the weird continuity stuff, though.
Well, I didn't miss it. I'm just setting the stage,
okay.
This Hydra-run New York has got a mean detention program for the lawbreakers that's akin to the grinder scene in Pink Floyd's The Wall.
basically reconstituted
to their organic matter. Enter Ian Rogers. Wait, what? Ian Rogers, in R616, the new cap, Sam Wilson Falcon cap, thought that Ian Rogers died in a showdown where Zemo's, or not Zemo, Arnim Zola's base exploded. But it seems like Ian Rogers escaped. He had taken on the new Nomad moniker. So Nomad escaped and reached the Infinity Elevator, which I think...
But it is Zemo, too.
Is it? Oh, yeah, it was Zemo's twice. Base. You're right.
Yeah, he escaped, you know, I guess Zola, and then he escapes Zemo. And it's rather weird because he must have... Like, the incursion must have been happening at the same time. So it's like he jumps from one place... And he ends up in another place.
On the Infinity Elevator. Third floor, yeah. Please. Ding.
So otherwise, he's held in that space until, you know, until there was somewhere to go. And then
until
there's
Doom
even...
could have pulled him out of the ether.
Yeah. Or then there's even, like, it seems like the door, I don't know if the door closes, or it seems like the door is still there at one point. So I'm like, if he goes back, there's no world to go back to. So I'm wondering if he would just die in... nothingness, or Doom can just pull him back. Like it's some kind of weird thing, and it totally feels like it's just another issue of like Remender's Captain America.
There's no going back, Kevin.
Apparently.
So the cool thing is that it's R616 Ian Rogers, yeah. Nomad. Well, he wasn't from R616 to begin with, but you get the idea. But here's another character who made it through the incursion. With full memories of who he is and what's this new world and blah, 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 which is really cool. So he's in this police state. He's getting on the radar of Hydra, right? Because he is making waves and he's learning about the place as we, the reader, do. Very interesting and great paced issue.
Yeah, it also reminds me of like that Cap story where it was like a four-parter where it's like, oh yeah, what if they... Nazis had taken over like New York or America or something, and it was supposed to take place like sort of like you see Captain America's like in an ice cube, so it's sort of like some weird alternate reality dream type world.
One.
You know, those fun types of stories are like, well, what if they lost World War II or whatever?
Yeah, except this is our you know, a guy who knows our reality taking that mindset there. That's cool.
And it's the Zola, I think, takes a little bit from the movie where he sort of uploaded his consciousness into some big screen type thing.
Yeah.
As opposed to being some weird little mutant guy running around with a TV in his chest.
Well, isn't he also like, he is Big Brother? Like,
sure.
Like literally on the TV screen and everything.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like he was in the commercial.
there is a nice, twist how they resolve the fate of one of the characters. It was really nice and actually surprised me a little, so I like that near the end of the book.
All right, Korvac Saga number one. Ooh, I was waiting to get to this one. Written by Dan Abnett with art by Otto Schmidt.
The Red Skull.
And Chris Peter colors, and I like this Otto Schmidt. I'm not familiar with his other work, but it's very, I really liked it.
This features the classic Guardians of the Galaxy, Vance Astro, Starhawk, Charlie 27, Yondu, Martin X, Nikki, and the recent Guardians 3000 series linchpin, Earth Girl Gina Drake. The first half of this issue is them acting in official capacity, chasing down a seeming drunk. But this drunk's name is Emil Blonsky, so we know what he's capable of. And Andrew, he's got the madness.
Yes, the space madness.
People develop visions of pre-Doom Marvel Universe, pre-incursion world, and question the lack of stars in the sky, the night sky and stuff, and they're considered to have the madness, and they go crazy.
And they turn into monsters, too.
Well, when he goes nuts, he's Emil Blonsky, so he gets all abominable. And there's a nice big brawl there. The second half of the issue has them reporting back to Forest Hills' Baron Korvac and his wife, Karina. And this introduces the dynamic between Forest Hills and the neighboring Holy Wood. And Holy Wood's Baron is Simon Williams, Wonder Man, who is visiting, in official capacity. And they are competitors and trying to get one up on each other, Korvac and Simon Williams. The issue ends with Karina looking up at the night sky, the blank black night sky, and wondering to herself, where are the stars?
And when Wonder Man travels, he travels, his crew is the Avengers, but it's the Yellow Jacket, Jocasta, Vision, Moondragon, Hercules, Captain Marvel, Black Panther, and Black Widow. Like, what a fun, fun group.
And I love the interactions, again, because their bosses are trying to get the one-up on each other, and because they're visiting the Korvac domain, like, as ambassadors, they're puffing up their chests a lot, right? So the Guardians are trying to be respectable hosts and not fly off the handle, but, like, some of the scenes are great, like Hercules patting Charlie 27 on the back and, like, really hurting him, and Charlie's like, I hate that guy.
Yeah, it's a fun... It's like a... They quickly... Abnett has a great way of quickly establishing the world and the characters and everything without a lot of... You know, he knows all the shorthands to use, so we know, oh, this guy's this type of character, this type is this, this is set up. Like, just a really great... Jams a lot of setup in this.
Karina, in our reality, Karina was the daughter of the Collector. You recall that? And she was with Korvac at first, sort of like a spy. And so I wonder if any of that is being... She's a cosmic being to begin with, as Korvac was. So it's interesting. I'm very anxious to see how this one goes.
Well, I don't want to spoil much, but in two, it ramps up even more.
Great.
It goes, I've read two. It's fun. I'm much pleased. Like I said, a lot of it's the art team unfamiliar with it, but really, really fun. I like the kind of the angles and the misproportions a little bit. It's just very comic book to me.
Also very comic booky was the Red Skull number one, written by Joshua Williamson with art by Lucia Pizzari under a Riley Rossmo cover.
Here's a Thunderbolts book.
It sure was. Crossbones assembles a reluctant team of five individuals who have gotten on Doom's radar.
Roll call.
For rebellious, blasphemous activities.
Kevin, do you want to tell us who our team is?
All right. So this issue. We have House of M, Magneto. And is that House of M, Lady Deathstrike?
I don't know. But the Magneto, too, he's that White Knight Magneto, you know, yeah. Current.
Jack-O-Lantern, who's really awesome. I'll disagree with anyone if they say... I just remember a famous... con thing where he's silly or stupid, some artist said. He's just a pumpkin with his head on fire. I'm like, that's why he's awesome. And then you have the Winter Soldier, who apparently volunteered and isn't, like, right. Really villainous.
Yeah, no, he's the only one who's not in trouble.
Yeah. And then Moonstone, but her costume is, like, one that we'll recognize from modern day.
And Electro. Then
Ultimate Universe Electro, where he's all blue and electrical-like, I guess.
Old. That's the big clue.
Yeah, so yeah, that too.
Cool lightning bolt hat.
And he'll have, like, a real awesome moment later on when he gets... What happens to him is just like, what?
Hilarious. So the mission is to determine the fate and verify the death of the Red Skull. The Red Skull was a Doom heretic who developed his own zealot followers after being martyred by being tossed over the shield, over the wall. And then myths developing about the Red Skull's possible survival. In fact, Crossbones himself said he survived fighting his way out of the Deadlands and isn't willing to go back in there. Now it's their turn. He's going to send them in to see if his boss is still alive or to bring the body back or die trying.
Yeah, that doesn't seem that likely that someone could survive. You have all this stuff built up about the world and you're like, wow, it doesn't seem like that many people would be able to survive in a zombie Ultron.
But did you get to the last page, Kevin?
Yeah.
Okay. Well, they also
kind of exciting.
They have some. Their powers are being dampened a bit, too. So that's a further.
That sucks in a firefight.
I'm glad that the real Electro takes care of business in this case.
Sweet.
Well said. All right, Siege number one, written by Kieran Gillen with art by Felipe Andrade under a W. Scott Forbes cover. And there are two other artists that contribute double-page spreads that we'll get to when we get to them. Siege number one follows Abigail Brand. She is the doom-sentenced shield maiden, now the head shield maiden, tasked to, for the rest of her life, protect and defend the shield. And she has recently taken over from Nick Fury, who is missing in action over the shield wall.
This is like the Gillen character book.
Andrade's double page spread that shows the shield wall, like right towards the beginning of the issue. Wow. Wow.
You would not be for. I really like this book, but you would also not be forgiven if you didn't notice this reads an awful lot like our Marvel Zombies. Like, she's following a similar kind of character arc to Moonstone in a way. Or, sorry, Elsa Bloodstone.
Elsa gets thrown over the wall, though, and has to go south even further away from the wall.
Right, but both characters were like these hard-bitten women who who want to serve on the wall. They don't want to go and live in the different worlds. They're actively seeking the wall, and they have that kind of blasé, like, nothing affects me.
Her parents were killed when Abigail Brand's parents were killed when part of the wall was broken down and there was a contagion. So she's all tied into giving it back to those zombies, Ultrons, and Annihilation Wave creatures that are on the other side of the wall. What's funny too is this issue collects some other S.H.I.E.L.D. related characters like Hickman and Dustin Weaver's Leonardo da Vinci. Did you catch him? Which I thought he was funny to have him there. And hey, it's Lady Catherine of Bishop and Miss America Chavez, both sentenced to be S.H.I.E.L.D. maidens in other stories that we touched upon earlier.
Yeah, I thought that was really cool that they're making an effort to tie everything in. That was like a fun. I like when they do that, and it's all one. It makes it feel like at least some of these books are more. But the premise is also the setup of she's losing her second and getting a new one.
Right. There's a James Stokoe double-page spread of Annihilation Wave forces being blasted with optic blasts being shot through a big lens and amplified. And then there's a Jorge Coelho double-page spread recounting that last time that there was a containment breach on the wall that I mentioned before. So with that setup established, what happens is that Kang appears and delivers a 20 days and counting prophecy to when the wall is going to totally fall and mentions Thanos as being the cause. Dun, dun, dun.
Yeah, it seems like this one might be more central than you might have thought with the tie-ins to the different books. If you're trying to keep to more of the main stories, this might be one. I mean, other than the fact it's also a good book, it might be one you might want to. I mean, I only read the first one, but it seems like this is more central than some of the other ones we're going through.
All right, two more, kids. Spider Island number one, which has a Umberto Ramos cover and is written by Christos Gage with art by Paco Diaz. And this gives us a reality where remember the whole Spider Island thing? There was a virus and everyone turned spidery and there was the queen who was controlling it all. Well, the spider virus and the queen, they won the war. And they ruled supreme, and Spider Island truly is a Spider Island. There's a small enclave of humans that are protected by Spider Woman, Agent Venom, the Flash Thompson venom-coated soldier, and the Vision.
They have a part-time helper, Steve.
Yeah, that's a pretty cool encounter. They encounter Jack Russell, who during the day is under the Queen's spell, but at a full moon at night in werewolf by night form, he's one of their allies.
That's so weird.
The Avengers, they've all turned. They're all after these last humans.
Spider-Hulk, Crush.
Spider-Man himself died during the original war. The history all gets explained in a nice big flashback. And we're going to see Cap-Wolf. Remember Cap-Wolf?
They had a real fun way of trying to change the status quo. Like, this is like a fun, like if you like goofy monsters and, like if Jack Russell's a character you like, I think you like this book with the tone that it struck and the change at the end.
Yeah, cause that's the angle. If the werewolf isn't the werewolf, isn't controlled by the Spider Queen when he's werewolf, what happens if we change, you know, some other people who already are enslaved? So, Cap-Wolf.
That's the whole Cap-Wolf saga all over again.
The lizard formula into the Hulk. How about Man-Wolf's Moonstone, the Godstone? And they use Morbius's blood to inject into Carol Danvers to see. It's not clear whether it's going to break them of the spell or not, but we'll see if it works.
Yeah, it's really, I thought this was fun. And then the first issue has a little backup with May Parker, that version, the kind of spinoff world.
It's a 10-page backup by Tom DeFalco and Ron Frenz and Sal Buscema, who those are the original Spider-Girl creators, but it's Mayday, and a backup that features the entire MC squared bunch of characters. What's cool, though, Andrew, is it follows immediately the Spider-Verse event. This is where these characters were left off Spider-Verse, with Spider-Ben, you know, living with Mayday and everything. So we get this revisitation of the MC squared universe with like the A-Next characters who end up thinking that May is an imposter and are out to get her. That something weird going on though, where they're being like mind controlled or something, but this is going to keep going as a little serial backup in this Spider Island title. So I think that's cool, getting this little glimpse into what happened after the Spider-Verse.
Yeah, I really, the fun tone of it, I mean, even though it's serious, like all these books are quote-unquote serious, I thought this one would be one I would suggest if you like monsters and transformations, and then having the Mayday Parker. I like that. I read them in the little digest form, that because they also had the Wolverine's kid was in that and all those goofy ones. Mm-hmm. They were just kind of fun. That what would you call? I don't remember the name of it. MC squared.
Yeah,
or
right.
Whatever. It's not MC2. It was a
fun. Well, it was equal. It was MC. Not a subscript. It was up to the side. Like a square.
Yeah, it was just fun. Because I think it wasn't it aimed at like a younger crowd, maybe?
It was supposed to be another Marvel 2099 type of thing, the next generation. But because it was DeFalco and Friends and everything, it was just of, lighter fare, and it all spun out of Spider-Girl's successful appearance in a popular What If.
Yeah, I thought one of the other famous things was it used, like, Clone Saga continuity.
Oh, is that right?
Like the...
No,
well, the,
she wasn't
the,
supposed to
the
be
whole,
the...
The whole stuff was with, she? Like, Kane, the Seer, and then, you know, the
Spider-Girl herself actually surviving rather than, you know, what happened in the main books.
All right, last one is Star-Lord and Kitty Pryde, number one, written by Sam Humphries with art by Artie Fermarsha.
Yeah, that's good for me. I'm I'm glad you, well, also the colors, Jessica Colleen. Man, they need pronunciation guys with these names.
This is
but
the
not that Kitty Pryde.
This is the Star-Lord from our Marvel Universe, who made it through on the life raft, as we know from the main title, but since has separated from the others from the raft. And he's hiding out at Black Bolt's quiet room, lounge in Manhattan, singing Disney tunes. But
because no one knows that Disney... I've seen that in other, alternate universe books where someone takes...
Sure.
Something that y'all know and uses it there to great success.
Because he's got all his memories, you dig? But he wouldn't know the Disney songs because he... But never mind. He's been off-world, right? Since he was a little kid. But anyway...
But he still gets it beamed up there. You know,
oh,
Steve.
Okay. All right. He still loves Kitty. He just got engaged to her in the regular Marvel Universe, and she's gone after the incursion, right? Enter Kitty Pryde. Course, like
well,
you said, Kevin.
He goes under the name Steve Rogers. I like that, too.
As you said, Kevin, it's not our Kitty. It's not his Kitty. But he kisses her anyway and gets slugged for it. But he ends up getting identified by her as a, again, I've used this word a lot, and that's because of the whole Doom thing. He is a heretical anomaly. And she quickly cuffs herself to him and runs him off to bring him back to Doom. So it sounds like it's going to be like a bounty buddy romance movie romp.
Yes, for sure. I'm seeing, what was the Charles Grodin, Robert De Niro one? But that's a common trope, the two star-crossed people attached and they'll grow to hopefully love. Because he's clearly hooked on her. This art has a very... sort of manga feel to it to me. I mean, not as a knock. You don't read it backwards or anything, but the facial expressions and the character designs have that feel to it a little bit. Like when Kitty Pryde's announced on that scene with the waiter with the very stereotypical Frenchman look to him, and she's got kind of the space dress on and everything. Yeah, it was a fun kind of... I kind of wish we'd gotten more into, jumped a little bit further ahead, because it was very setup-y, and I think they could have cut to the chase a bit quicker, but fun characters, you know? It's good to see. I like the ones that have the characters from our universe.
Yeah.
Although I guess Star-Lord is just kind of bailing on the whole group. Like, I thought this might be more tied in, but I don't know. It feels like it's going to be a very side mission, and maybe he's not going to have anything to do with screwing around with Doom and changing the status quo.
All right, we made it through another group of Secret Wars-related number one issues. There still hasn't been, like, a real stinker among them, has there?
No.
They've all been pretty good.
It's like a real dud. I mean, some are more to my taste than others, but yeah, I've been impressed. And the ones I've liked, I haven't had a big turn where when I've gotten the second or third issue, I'm like, ugh.
All right, stick around, true believers. We've got one more book to cover for you before the episode's over.
Where's the Fantastic Four in this? Can you answer that for me, Steve? Like, I don't get how you could...
Well...
Like, I know it's an Avengers story, I just don't...
Well, what Avengers story are we talking about here, gang? It is pretty timely for what we're dealing with in the current Doom battle world of Secret Wars, and that is a Marvel graphic novel from 1987 from an idea by David Michelinie, Jim Shooter, and Mark Gruenwald, written by Michelinie with art by Bob Hall. It's Emperor Doom.
Yeah, I've been reading a lot of Doom this year. Like, I read that Triumph and Torment. You know, the famous Doom Doctor Strange story where they go to try to save Doom's
love it.
mother from Mephisto, her soul and everything.
Yeah, that's a great one.
And then I remember this one specifically because there was like a graphic novel area, and this was always face out, and I never had like enough money or whatever, and I was always like, Emperor Doom, yeah, Doom's the man, and this seemed like the Doom, like one of those the Doom story type of things, and it's like one of the things I love about Doom, where like, yeah, if he took over the world, you know, you wouldn't have any freedom, but it would be a utopia, and that whole mindset, and yeah, he's a ruler, so he has diplomatic immunity, what are you going to do? It's like all those Doom ideas and how I love Doom, and Doom was in like that Dr. Doom's Revenge computer game. So it was like, I really wanted to read this, but then I, you know, never got around to having it. For some reason, it was the one thing I have on my bookshelf that was like bagged and with a board in the center. So I guess when I bought it, like that's how they keep some of these old graphic novels from falling apart too badly. They put a board in the center of something that's a little wobbly.
Sure. Well, back then, the graphic novel meant something, not just any old square-bound comic or any old original story, but here, you knew you were going to get an original story. It was going to be album-sized soft cover, right? It was going to be at least the content of, like, two annuals as far as size and scope, but it would be all one story. It'd be more sophisticated and intense, more graphic, bloody. You might even get a little boob or something like that if you were lucky. And the cover price on this one, this was 87, so the graphic novel line had already been going for years. $10, $9.95 cover price, so I can see why you were stuck waiting.
$10.
Bob Hall with the art was great here. Really channeling his Neil Adams at times, especially on the inks, which was fantastic. And has anyone drawn a better Tigra?
Yeah,
seriously.
She sticks out for sure, yeah.
Wow. But you said, where's the Fantastic Four, and joked on that. This really, you know, even though there are some of the other Avengers in it, it's really a West Coast Avengers story is what it is.
Yeah.
You know?
But I didn't notice, like, there's certain things where I'm like, yeah, okay, they don't want to derail the story. Like, there's certain plot points. But some things I didn't notice until they, like, pointed them out. Like, oh, where I have to, like, I just assumed with what Doom is using, we'll get into it, to like sort of mind control everyone. Then he goes into this thing about, well, there's only three people that will resist me. And then once he points that out, I'm like, wouldn't there be like dozens? Like,
yeah.
I'm just like,
for the purposes of this story, for the purposes of the story, there are only three people who can.
I know. And I'm like, well, if you just had it be to do the mind control, then you wouldn't have to do that. But yeah, I guess robots or whatever, you can't.
This is an Avengers story.
Yeah, it's just weird.
What Doom does is he uses the Purple Man's organics to enslave Namor, and then uses Namor to take out the machines that would be getting in his way in the Avengers-related world, who are Machine Man and the Vision. He gets them subordinated. And then proceeds.
I was going to say, is this pre-Jocasta, I guess?
No, it's not, but she is dead at this time. He enslaves mankind, Doom does. Takes the whole darn thing over. But not Simon Williams, because he's ionized, right? And
Wonder Man.
Simon goes into hiding. You know, he's an actor, so he must know how to do acting makeup, too. He puts on his disguise. He looks like the, like the brawny paper towel man or something. And goes off and decides he's just going to slip away. But his conscience keeps clawing at him. And he learns a lesson or two and realizes he's got to make a stand. So he goes and he manages to turn Captain America and Hawkeye. And after that, then they have their small group of rebels here and against Doom, which is exactly what Doom wants. Doom, as a leader, it explores the whole thing of being a ruler. And if you're a violent challenger to the rule, and that's how you've taken your kinghood and your kingdom, once you're a conqueror, then what do? There's nothing left to conquer, and you're stuck dealing with all the minutiae of being a ruler, all the diplomatic stuff, all the dealing with farm subsidies, right, Kevin, and things like that.
This is one of the things, like, I always want to see in some stories, like, what happens after, like, I guess the same thing with the Age of Apocalypse, like, I always wanted to see, like, oh, this, what happens if the villains win for a while, just to see how it is on the other side, just to see that story told once, maybe not 1,000 times in a row. Same thing with this, like, well, what if Doom actually takes over the world, and then I want to see what happens after, and then you find out what's after, and then Doom's sort of like, ugh, man, now I gotta figure out, get this other farm going, or this one state wants to separate from the U.S., and I'm like, I can't see a reason why they wouldn't at this point, like, everything's peace, so yeah, sure, if you wanna, but yeah, he's all his paperwork and stuff, and he's just like, oh, man. Like, middle management, Dr. Doom, he's just like, too much paperwork.
And this is something that Roy Thomas had explored when he first started doing King Conan comic books for Marvel, too, is the conqueror king who wants to be out there fighting with his horde, because that's what he does and that's what he's best at, and that's what got him where he is. He's supposed to put all that behind and suddenly deal, you know, with being a ruler. And Doom here, he finds it wanting. It's not enough for him. That's why he's thrilled when there's a little rebellion to deal with. To deal with personally, I'm going to deal with it.
He wants some challenge. I have to think of Battle World. I'm like, well, you're keeping the whole world together for Secret Wars, and there's a lot of craziness going on. So I'm like, yeah, that must keep Doom interested. Well, here it's not as interesting for him.
There's a great sequence where Namor, now that he has been turned back, which is great, they used water to splash all over Namor and kind of revive him and give him the opportunity to fight against the Purple Man's control. And Namor is going to destroy the crystal lens type housing that the Purple Man is encased within, that all his power is being amplified from. And Doom, from a remote location, sees Namor doing this and about to free the Purple Man, and he goes to push the button. He's got a failsafe in place for this. He's Emperor Doom, right? He's gonna recoup his losses here and start anew, and he goes to push the button to enact his failsafe plan, and then, like, they start flashing panels of, like, him dealing with, again, that diplomatic minutia and not the farmers again, and he hesitates and hesitates, and then he just pulls his hand away, and he's like, you know what, let's let fate decide how this ends up, and just sits back, and, of course, Namor breaks the Purple Man free, and Doom escapes in the end. But I thought that whole slowing down that moment of Doom reaching for that button and thinking about it, like, I don't know, what is this really going to mean for me? I felt that to be very Dr. Doomy, the whole sequence.
Yeah. We also get to see Machine Man in here. And what's on the back cover, too, is when Doom goes to the United Nations. And I have to mention this because it reminds me of, like, those Spider-Man cartoons. Like, one of them was Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, and, like, every second episode seemed to be, like, Dr. Doom. And it's like, I'm sure he goes to the United Nations in that cartoon a few times.
Yeah,
so it's just like, oh, here he is again. And then he's like, yes, yes, clap for me, I'm so awesome. And then you see all these world leaders and all this stuff, and I'm like, yes, this is what I want to see, because he is a world leader. They would allow him there.
And then Spider-Man and His Amazing Friends, it reminds me of the one where he has to collect the three parts of the amulet, and that'll make him the most powerful. All his wishes will come true.
Emperor Doom, worth checking out if you want to get idea of one of those pastimes where Doom's ruled everything.
Yeah, he was just, you know,
he's done this before. Yeah, exactly. All right, our next episode of Marvel Noise will be our episode 250 Spectacular, with a rundown of every Marvel issue number 250 ever, plus Thunderbolts, right?
Yeah, plus a Vault issue.
Until Shellhead's Silver Centurion armor comes back to stay, make mine Marvel. Later.
With this Infinity Gauntlet, I, Thanos, will rule the universe!
All right, squaddies, time to hero up!